Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast series Hate Crime on the Two Islands.
This project seeks to explore key aspects of the law reform processes with respect to hate crime that are occurring in England and Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Ireland. My name is Mark Walters and I'm a Professor of Criminal Law and Criminology at the University of Sussex, and with me is my colleague and co-host Professor Jennifer Schwepp, who is an Associate Professor at the University of Limerick.
With our special guests each week who bring a fresh perspective to the issue, we explore themes and developments across our two islands to inform debate and practice.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode 2 of Hate Crime on the Two Islands. The series explores key aspects of law reform with respect to hate crime in England and Wales, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Ireland. My name is Mark Walters and I'm a Professor of Criminal Law and Criminology at the University of Sussex, and my co-presenter on the series is Dr. Jennifer Schwepp, who is a Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Limerick. So in today's session, we ask the very important question of who should be protected in hate crime legislation. And with us today to discuss this topic is Dr. Amanda Haynes, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Limerick, and also co-director of the Centre, the European Centre for the Study of Hate. And with Amanda, I have Martin Wimpole, who is a lawyer at the Law Commission for England and Wales, who has worked tirelessly on their 2020 consultation paper entitled Hate Crime Laws. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Nice to be here.
You're very welcome. Okay, so across the United Kingdom, there are different characteristics covered in different laws, leading to what some have referred to as a hierarchy of hate. So in England and Wales, there are 5 protected characteristics: race, religion, sexual orientation, disability, and what is termed in law as transgender identity. But only 2 of those characteristics are covered as aggravated offences in criminal law. Northern Ireland, a slightly different approach is taken, whereby sentencing legislation covers race, religion, sexual orientation or disability, but excluding transgender identity. While recent changes in the law in Scotland have resulted in additional characteristics being added to those 5 characteristics, including that of age and variations in sex characteristics. And finally, a new bill has been recently introduced in Ireland, which includes gender in that list. So clearly there's a lack of consistency here across the two islands. So can I start with you, Martin? I wonder whether you could begin by saying just a little bit about how the Law Commission has approached this quite thorny question of who should be included in hate crime legislation.
Sure, thanks, Matt. So yeah, you're right. This is obviously a very challenging question, and it has a sort of unavoidable political dimension to it as well. And for me and for us as neutral civil servants, this is, you know, somewhat uncomfortable territory. So we've tried to approach the question that we're asked in our terms of reference as methodically and transparently as we could. And what we've done in our consultation paper is try and identify some criteria on which we could base our ultimate recommendations to government about which groups or characteristics should be included. I wouldn't say there's any real magic to the approach that we've taken in developing those criteria. We've drawn on the work of academic and policy experts who've considered this question for years. But broadly, we've tried to distill some of the core rationales for why hate crime laws exist in the first place, particularly recognising aspects such as the additional harm it causes to victims and to the wider community. And then we've then set this against sort of wider criminal law principles, and most notably that of the principle of minimal criminalisation. So it sort of became a task of trying to merge the principled reasons as to why you might want to include a characteristic in hate crime laws with more pragmatic considerations. For example, how might you actually fairly apply those criteria in practice, and what would be the real implications of including a characteristic in hate crime laws?
I wonder whether you could just perhaps elaborate for our listeners on what do you mean by minimal criminalisation? What is that?
Sure. So that's really the principle that the law should only criminalise conduct where it's absolutely necessary. So there needs to be a clear evidential basis for doing so. And it, for us, it's something that informs a lot of the work that we do in the criminal law sphere at the Law Commission. And it sort of emphasises restraint in the use of the criminal law. In this case, in terms of considering whether, you know, more offending should be either classed as a hate crime or specific offences of criminal hatred be created.
I'm wondering, why is that so important that we apply a minimal criminalisation concept to criminal law?
Well, I guess that's really getting to sort of deeper principles of sort of liberty and society. It's something that we sort of try to not constrain unnecessarily people's individual freedom and liberty in a free and democratic society.
Could I ask there, Martin, because I'm really interested in this, because I would see how the principle of minimal criminalisation would apply to the thresholds, for example. But if we accept that there should be protected characteristics, does the principle of minimal criminalisation apply to the breadth of that? Do you see what I mean? Like once the offending behaviour meets the threshold, does that principle operate with respect to creating hierarchies or creating protected and not protected characteristics?
I suppose it does, to the extent that we don't think there should be more severe treatment of existing criminal offences unless there's a sort of clearly demonstrable evidence base to do so. And that sort of links back to why we have hate crime laws in the first place. So it's sort of it's a linked chain, I guess, considering, you know, first of all, whether or not something should be included, and then why it should have a higher penalty.
Okay, so I'm wondering if perhaps you could set out what the criteria is then.
So the first criteria we identified was demonstrable need. And this really is probably the most connected to the idea of, in our view anyway, of minimal criminalisation. It considers the available evidence of the prevalence of the criminal targeting of the characteristic group based on prejudice or hostility. And in our paper, we've sort of broken this up into three substituent categories: the absolute prevalence, which is sort of the overall numbers, relative prevalence, which is the sort of proportionate targeting of that community. So a group might be a relatively small group within the community, but be very disproportionately targeted for hostile bias-based crime. And also the severity. So we're talking about, you know, really serious violent criminal offending that might also weigh on an inclusion within that first criteria. The second criterion is additional harm. And this looks at the evidence that the criminal targeting based on hostility or prejudice towards that characteristic causes additional harm both to the individual victim, members of the targeted group, and also to society more widely by sort of damaging social cohesion, damaging sort of democratic participation of individuals within society. And I think, to be frank, this is probably the most difficult criteria to apply in practice. It's quite reliant on some sort of sociological research, but as well as a victim testimony and community testimony. We've sort of tried to distill what some of the elements of this might be, what some of the aspects, underpinning aspects that mean that hate crime might sort of be more harmful. And we've looked at whether or not we could be, crime could be experienced as an attack on the identity of the victim, and whether or not the sort of targeting might be seen to compound any sort of existing discrimination or disadvantage from which that group already experienced in society. The final characteristic is sort of the most is suitability. It's the most pragmatic criteria, and it seeks to sort of ground the first two more principled considerations in the practical realities of how hate crime laws work. So I guess it's sort of recognising that the way in which hate crime laws work as a sort of either a sentencing aggravation or aggravated offences model in most jurisdictions are a particular legal mechanism. And there may be sort of other policy reasons to do with the wider criminal law, which mean that despite a principal case for inclusion being clear, there are sort of policy implications that might be quite undesirable, sort of unintended consequences. So it's a bit of a check on a purely principled approach to inclusion of a characteristic within hate crime laws. So that's really very broadly the approach we've proposed. We don't claim it's the only approach, but we consider it to be sort of a workable framework for considering this rather difficult question that we were presented with.
Martin, we might talk later on about that third characteristics in the context of your comment about neutral civil servants. I'm quite interested, you know, is it ultimately, are you ultimately making a pragmatic decision based on principled grounds? But what happens, and Amanda, you might come in here, you know, I think that we'd all agree that in an ideal world, if all of this information is available, these are definitely ways in which we can determine the breadth of legislation with respect to protected characteristics. But what happens to those individuals or group who experience bias-motivated crimes, which remain undetected, where civil society hasn't, you know, moved towards monitoring this type of offence, or where, like in Ireland, there's little data at all? Do you know what I mean? So do you think that the Law Commission's approach to this has a universal appeal and or application? What's your take on it?
I think it definitely has a universal appeal. I suppose the question is whether it's possible to apply universally. I mean, I you know, was very impressed reading the report by that very kind of systematic and methodical approach that was taken to considering the available evidence, but also by the range and quality of the evidence that was available. And, you know, I think that, as you said, ideally we do this on an evidence-informed basis, and ideally we're talking about research evidence, aren't we, you know? Ideally, maybe victimization surveys, for example. But I suppose that the Irish jurisdiction is quite interesting in that when you look at kind of parallels in terms of the available evidence in relation to the kind of protected categories that we'd be considering in both contexts, we don't always have the same availability of data. So I suppose ideally, you know, we might have a situation where the state is collecting the data, where we'd have official statistics on it. In relation to data in respect to the hate crime, that data that is collected by the police in an Irish context, you know, it doesn't meet the standards of national statistics. So it's, you know, published under restriction and or not published at all, as the case may be. We find ourselves in many cases reliant on the surveys that are conducted by EUFRA, by the Fundamental Rights Agency. And they've actually been really important to our understanding of the experiences, in particular, of LGBTIQ plus people in Ireland, and also, for example, the traveller populations in terms of their experiences of hate crime and hate incidents. But for many other groups, really, there's a real absence of systematic research on their experiences. Or certainly large-scale systematic research on their experiences. And so, for example, in relation to people with disabilities in Ireland, there's really nobody who is collecting data on an ongoing basis about people's experiences of hate crime or hate incidents. There was an excellent smaller scale study that was done in a specific geographic region in Cork by Claire Edwards, which took into account people's experiences of unsafety in urban spaces, and which certainly would be indicative of some particular manifestations of hate crime and hate incidents. But as I said, otherwise, we really have got a gap in relation to that particular protected category and others. And where there might be an absence of data collected by the state or by the European Union, then the onus falls, I think, upon civil society organisations to try to generate that data when they are making their submissions and trying to support their submissions if they wish to advocate for the inclusion of that protected category. And then the question becomes about which civil society organisations might have the resources or the capacity to produce that type of research evidence. And then we really get into the question of how disadvantage is not only linked to maybe experiences of hate crime, but to your ability to evidence those experiences in a way that will be listened to by those with the capacity to protect you through legislation.
So ultimately what you're saying, Amanda, is that the reason that we have hate crime legislation could result in groups being excluded from legislation simply because of that extreme disadvantage. On that, Martin, can I ask if your third suitability ground, does that operate purely as an exclusionary criteria, or can it also be an inclusionary criteria? Do you see what I mean? So I can see why it would operate on an exclusionary basis, but you know, has it been thought about? Reframe that question and try and be a little bit more articulate. what about where there is no evidence of demonstrable need and no evidence at all? You know, and I could see where there might be evidence of demonstrable need, but none with respect to additional harm. Can the suitability criteria operate on an inclusionary basis?
We haven't approached it in that way. We've seen it more as a check on the sort of more principled rationales. I do think Amanda raises some really interesting points about evidence, though. I mean, even in England and Wales, we only have the evidence, largely the evidence. The strongest evidence is of the categories that are already included. So we do have reasonably good statistics around, you know, the five categories protected in England and Wales. But to an extent, we don't know what we don't know still. We don't have as good data sources on the other characteristics that we're considering. There are some, so police forces, you know, have recorded alternative subculture hate crimes for quite some time. Some forces have recorded crimes against sex workers. Misogyny is now included in a number of police forces, but these are not complete data sets, and they are sort of piloty, perception based, not backed by law. So there is a limit to the data that we have to work with. But I don't think we've taken the approach that, notwithstanding the evidence of sort of demonstrable need, suitability might sort of come in and allow for inclusion in any event. So it is a somewhat conservative approach, I suppose, going back to the sort of points I was making earlier around minimal criminalisation and only expanding the remit of the law as far as we can sort of justify based on evidence.
I wonder if I might follow up with this particular question with both of you in terms of how the criteria might apply to hate crime law and how hate crime law might do different things depending on the jurisdiction or the criminal justice system or what you want it to do. So hate crime laws can create new criminal offences, or they can recriminalise offences. Yeah. So you might have, for example, racially aggravated assault. Now that relabels the offence, and in the context of England and Wales, it quadruples the maximum penalty. Mm-hmm. But that has a pretty big impact, doesn't it, on both what an offender might be labelled as, what kind of punishment they have. And that's this has implications, doesn't it, for minimal criminalisation, but also due process rights and, you know, general human rights in terms of liberal democracy only criminalising behaviour which is particularly harmful, etc. But what about hate crime legislation that doesn't necessarily create new criminal offences but applies only at the sentencing stage? Or what about hate crime policy, whereby you might have a definition of hate crime that's used by the police, which then applies to what kind of crimes are investigated as hate crimes by the police, but not always necessarily what crimes might be prosecuted as hate crimes. So in other words, does it matter if we're looking at this criteria, and I kind of see Amanda's sort of critique there around, well, you know, can we get the evidence? You know, is it putting too much of an onus on civil society? Does it matter more if we're creating new criminal offences which recriminalise and label people as hate crime offenders versus whether we're applying this criteria to either policy or to sentencing legislation?
I think in this consultation paper, we argued that a distinction like that could be made. And for that reason, we said quite clearly that we need to sort of have fairly clearly defined categories when we're talking about aggravated offences in particular. But we said that perhaps there could be some more flexibility. Well, we asked whether there could be some more flexibility in terms of just concretely specifying characteristic groups in terms of enhanced sentencing. So we left that sort of open for consultees to express views, more or less recognizing the arguments, the sort of suggestion that Mark has made, that there is a particular level of seriousness that applies when you're talking about an aggravated offence with a significantly increased maximum penalty and a sort of inherent label versus what is closer to a sentencing consideration, although it does now come with that label in England and Wales at least as well, in terms of recording on the police national computer. So that's sort of my contribution. I'm not sure if that's helpful. I don't know if you have thoughts, Amanda.
Yeah, I definitely would make a distinction between when we're talking about police recording or policy versus when we're talking about how it's treated within the criminal justice system. And I suppose, again, there maybe is a circular relationship there. I mean, when you name something and create something so that it can be recorded, you generate statistics that evidence it, which might then produce what is needed or necessary to support actually legislating against that particular type of manifestation of prejudice. I suppose when we're talking about aggravated offences versus enhanced sentencing, then we get back into the question of, well, are we creating kind of two tiers? And I think that's been very, very problematic. I mean, you can talk about this on a more informed basis than I can in relation to England and Wales, but I think maybe your experience has been that can produce problems in and of itself. And it does seem to be, at least in the Irish context, that there has been an eagerness not to begin by creating those types of hierarchies, I think.
Yeah, I think as at least as far as it existing recognised categories are treated differently under laws in England and Wales, that's certainly a source of significant community disquiet and tension. I think that's well documented.
I suppose an alternative approach there might be one advocated, such as that by Cara Bacalis, who's written about using the same sort of list of characteristics in hate crime law that you will find in equality legislation. Those characteristics have already been identified as characteristics that are open to discrimination and forms of bias. So why not just simply use those in hate crime laws?
Well, I think one of the issues that comes to mind then is that if we're trying to do this on an evidence-informed basis as much as is possible, even if I suppose we maybe have to be a little more open-minded about what that evidence might constitute in the context of particularly disadvantaged or stigmatized groups who have difficulty in funding research. At the same time, if our goal is that we protect categories of people for which there is some evidence that they require protection, then you have to ask yourself, is that available in relation to all of those categories of individuals who'd be covered under equality legislation?
I mean, we did seriously consider this in our work in terms of developing criteria and guidelines to decide which characteristics might or might not be included. But we ultimately took the view in the consultation paper that the two contexts, the civil and criminal context, don't sort of map onto each other adequately. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, easy criticism when you look at something like the Equality Act is that it protects groups, characteristics such as pregnancy and marital status, which are not obviously suitable for hate crime laws because there's not particular evidence around those groups. I mean, I think if Cara was here, we'd say, I agree with that. It's a starting point, and then you work backwards and you consider, whether or not their criminal sort of test is also met. But it's a useful kind of guideline, and I think that is a way you could approach it. Sort of took the view, firstly, that although they are well established protections in the Equality Act, they also are the subject of their own kind of consideration and political debate. They're not sort of held down on high. So they're good guideline, but they're not necessarily the only way to approach it. And we preferred, given the particular criminal justice implications, to approach it more from a ground up approach rather than a sort of working backwards approach. But in saying that, I'm not critical of that approach. It's just not the one that we chose to pursue.
Yeah, it is, sometimes we think, oh, well, there's a list there. Perhaps that's a useful list. But, when we start reading some of the literature that those working in equality law produce. You know, they say, well, you know, yes, we have these characteristics, but they're not the be all and end all. And there's always, as you say, Martin, discussions as to inclusion or exclusion of particular characteristics. Amanda, can I ask, what characteristics do you think are not included in legislation in the three jurisdictions that have legislation? We'll leave Ireland aside for the moment. What characteristics are not included there that you think should be, or are there any characteristics that are included that you think, you know, it's time for them to shuffle off the statute books?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it's the million-dollar question, really, isn't it? And I think, you know, if there's one thing that you kind of end up concluding when you look at this area is that there isn't any perfect list. You know, no one person is going to generate a list that is completely defensible and isn't exclusionary of any group that really merits protection. You know, and at the end of the day, I think the decisions that are made, they're going to be politically informed, aren't they? I do think that one of the things that strikes me, I suppose, particularly, you know, having looked at the Criminal Justice Hate Crime Bill 2021, is that the category of gender is included there. And gender is inclusive of gender identity and gender expression. And I think that that is something that I would advocate for. And I think that's something that is for me, it's a very legitimate approach. I think that the protection of trans people through the category transgender identity sometimes can actually be a little bit exclusionary. It can be limiting in terms of how that category is defined. I think that gender identity and gender expression have the potential to be much more inclusive. And I think then that gender, as being inclusive of gender identity and gender expression, you know, obviously also provides for addressing misogynistic hate crime, but also avoids kind of creating this or perpetuating this falsehood that somehow cisgender people don't have gender identities or don't express their gender. So actually, I see that as being something that's quite exemplary, I suppose, about the general scheme in the Irish context.
And age, as Mark noted at the beginning, has been in that, I suppose, gender and age are two of the categories that were considered across all four law reform processes. You know, what is age? Like, by age, are we talking older age? Are we talking younger age? Because everyone, in the same way everyone has a gender, everyone has an age. Do any of you have any thoughts on that, on the inclusion of age as a protected characteristic?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think it's, again, I think it's a difficult one. In Northern Ireland, the recommendation was to include age as a protected characteristic. I think if we look at, I mean, I suppose even if you go back to the early work on how, you know, hate crime legislation was formulated in the United States and the role of different kind of social movements in the determination of which categories of people were protected under that legislation. One of the things that's really interesting about age is that in many cases, the civil society organizations who might advocate for the protection of people on the basis of age are actually split by age groups. So with some civil society organizations being focused on the need of children and other civil society organizations maybe being focused on the needs of older people. And I think going forward, that may be one of the things that proves challenging in terms of maybe drawing together the evidence that is needed, where people want to advocate for the inclusion of that protected category. And then I suppose the question is, you know, are there differences in terms of prevalence, severity and impact on the basis of the age group that we are talking about? And then the other question would be, I suppose, for people who are minors, is that already addressed through the law in other ways? And, you know, therefore, is it necessary to recriminalize it again in another form?
One way to, I suppose, solve all of these really thorny questions, and I've really enjoyed this conversation, is to, rather than have legislation which is inclusive of stated characteristics, that we almost do away with this notion of legislation by reference to stated characteristics and use an open-ended list, such as in New South Wales, where it states that an offence is aggravated where it's committed against a group of people to which the offender believed the victim belonged. What are your thoughts on that, as you know, just having a broad provision that doesn't state protects have particular characteristics stated?
I think when we considered this in our consultation paper, we did also give this serious consideration, but I think we formed the view that although sort of all crime and although all sort of bias crime is to be condemned, there are sort of particular forms of hatred and hostility in our society that are particularly dangerous and harmful. And I suppose racism would probably be the archetypal example of that. But I would probably argue that that's true of all of the five currently protected characteristics in England and Wales. And so we consider that there is, to a degree, an important declaratory aspect of actually including and labelling the forms of hatred that hate crime achieves. And I think there's also, as well as the sort of concerns I've indicated around the potentially overly inclusive approach of what you've described in terms of evidence-based member criminalisation, I think there's also some pragmatic considerations that would apply. So it does put sort of perhaps a sentencer in a bit of a difficult position in trying to decide, you know, who is in and out. It also potentially, and this is, as I'm sure you're aware, has been controversial in New South Wales, it can lead to the sort of recognition of some characteristics that people would consider quite socially damaging. In that example, it was pedophilia. You could also arguably include things like extremist political views. And I think, you know, authors such as Mason have argued that, you know, we can protect people without necessarily recognising and affirming some of those damaging qualities and characteristics in terms of hate crime laws. And so that would be a concern that we would have with them. Purely open approach.
I think if I can perhaps come in here, I think one of the things that we need to look at in answering these types of questions is, what is the purpose of hate crime legislation? What is the purpose of the concept of hate crime? What are we trying to achieve by legislating against it? And sort of the research that I've been carrying out with social psychologists at the University of Sussex over a number of years looks at what makes hate crime distinct. What is it about the nature and dynamics of hate which makes it a separate phenomenon to other types of crime? And we've always come back to this concept of group identity, group identity being sort of fundamental to understanding not only why people are targeted, but also how they're affected by it. And so our research, time and time again, found that the reason why hate crime hurts more, as Paul Oginski famously said, is because it's an attack against your identity, but not just your individual identity, your group identity. And the reason for that is that it threatens both your physical safety as a LGBT person or as a Muslim person or as a Black person or as a disabled person, but also it has a symbolic threat, and that is a threat towards your rights as an LGBT person or as a Muslim person to participate freely in society and equally in society. So it's about your values and your principles as who you are as an entire group of individuals. So if we're looking at who should be included in hate crime legislation, for me, it's about, well, which group are affected in this way because of their group identity? We know that those perceptions of threat are then linked to certain emotional outcomes such as anxiety and anger and feelings of shame. And that's quite distinct to hate crime victims, feeling shame about who you are. And that can lead to you changing your appearance or changing the way that you behave or the way you speak or the way you dress in order to fit into society. So what's distinct about hate crime is the impact that it has on individuals because of their group identity. So if when we're looking at things like age and other identities, for me, it comes down to, is there a group? Is there a threat that's experienced by that group because of their identity? And it may be that, yes, there is, maybe there isn't. And with age, it's a little bit more nebulous, is it? Because are we talking about young age? Are we talking about middle age? Are we talking about old age? Do people coalesce around as groups based on their age? Do they feel a sense of group identity, which might be threatened by targeted victimization? And if not, perhaps that might be a different type of offence, which is a legitimate type of separate crime that requires attention from the state, but maybe not under the umbrella of hate crime. So if you're going to have legislation which has sort of an open-ended list of groups, it comes down to who's going to determine whether that group is under threat and has a sense of group identity. Is it the court that decides it? Is it a jury that decides it? Or should the legislature really be determining that? And that kind of comes back to the criteria again of, is there demonstrable need? Is there additional harm? Is there suitability? So I'm not sure about these open-ended lists, especially for hate crime laws which recriminalize or specifically criminalize. It might be slightly different for sentencing legislation. One of the other things that it may bring into question is this issue of legal certainty. You know, are people able to say, well, I know if I target this particular group that could be a hate crime and that comes with additional punishment or not? And I know something that Jennifer works on is legal certainty. So maybe I'll throw that over to you, Jennifer, in terms of what are your thoughts on these open lists with regards to principles like legal certainty?
Yeah, I mean, they have lashed to commend them, don't they? Because, you know, the courts do this all the time and judges do this all the time in terms of, for example, provocation. You know, they make judgment calls on the manner in which the law operates. And, you know, that they are driven both by law, but also by other factors, you know, in Ireland, basic fundamental constitutional principles, for example. But that open, like, there's instinctively you go, oh, that's the way around it, right? You know, so we have all our characteristics, and then, you know, we hum and haw over age, or we hum and haw over homelessness or sex workers or one of the other sort of fourth tier of characteristics, as we might call them, or third tier, and having this sort of open-ended catch-all clause at the end of the list is so attractive. But I think that there are issues around the principle of certainty, because of course criminal legislation, criminal law must be certain and precise. And I think that particularly when we're talking about offences, aggravated offences, but even also for aggravated sentencing provisions, I think that that type of open-ended provision is probably void for certainty and can have those upsetting, if we're going to be honest with it, those upsetting kind of repercussions, like you highlighted, Martin, in relation to the New South Wales example. So I think they're so attractive instinctively, but ultimately, you know, there's legal policy, if you want to call it that, but also in practice, I think that they're maybe not as useful as we might think they are when we think about it again. Does it all really come back to that suitability ground, Martin? Do you know, is like all of this talk of principles and evidence and all the rest, and, you know, gathering evidence takes a long time and it's very expensive, as Mark will, I'm sure, attest to. You know, really, are we just making judgment calls here? Like, is the rest of it window dressing?
I think it's probably a fair criticism of the suitability criteria, as we call it, that it is quite sort of opaque and that it can take into account quite a range of different circumstances. And, you know, we did try and articulate the sort of things that we were looking at, and they are sort of fairly standard policy considerations. But I don't think it's quite as simple as that. I think, you know, we are looking, first of all, at whether or not there's a sort of clear case in principle. And I think some potential groups could be ruled out by, you know, a lack of evidence around this being a real problem in society, or you know, if hasn't come up, to be honest, as much of an issue, but this additional harm consideration, there might be some sort of categories where you might say it's not clear that, you know, the sort of shared identity disadvantage of this group is such that it warrants, you know, that principled case. But I guess suitability really comes down to kind of trying to place hate crime laws within a broader criminal law context that does already, you know, have specified criminal offences, that does have the capacity to sentence and use for sentences to consider aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and where in which there are other sort of policy frameworks in which particular forms of offending are understood. So I think one of the things that we said about sex or gender in our consultation paper was that, you know, we definitely recognise there's a huge wealth of evidence about, you know, very severe crimes that are committed against women on the basis that they're women, that disproportionately target women, in particular, most of those principled arguments are fairly clearly met. But what is less clear is this always necessarily the best way to address that kind of behaviour, and are there not other means, particularly in the context of areas such as sexual offending, which might be more appropriate? There's already sort of existing framework in England and Wales to deal with violence against women and girls, and is hate crime the right approach? And so that's sort of, I think, where suitability for us bites primarily. It's when you place this kind of framework that we sort of often consider in isolation into a broader criminal context. Does it actually work? Does it actually lead to better outcomes for victims, for perpetrators, for the community? Or could it have sort of consequences that may be detrimental?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what you're saying to me there about the practical considerations, they make a lot of logical sense. But I suppose, again, then if we think about the message element of hate crime legislation, how do we clarify to those groups who might not be included as protected categories because it is felt that somehow the law already adequately addresses their experiences? Nonetheless, when we're looking at legislation specifically on hate crime, what message does it send when those categories of individuals are not included? You know, especially, I suppose, when they meet those kind of criteria that Mark was talking about of being, you know, a group that is subject to historical oppression on the basis of kind of deep-seated cultural prejudices.
I wonder then what might be the answer if, you know, if the criteria is overly onerous in terms of requiring this evidence, which is really difficult to gather or to collate, and the equality legislation list, well, that has problems in and of itself. The open list, well, that's open to criticism. So in terms of the Irish context, where, you know, this is new, isn't it? You've got new hate crime legislation coming your way. What would you be recommending to your policymakers and legislators in terms of what groups should be protected or how the legislation might be constructed?
I think that if you look at the groups that they've actually decided to protect, they're actually quite expansive at the moment. So protected characteristics in the bill means race, colour, nationality, religion, ethnic or national origin, sexual orientation, gender or disability. And ethnic or national origin, it would be inclusive of membership of the travel community who are now recognised since 2017 in Ireland as an ethnic minority, but they'll be specifically named that definition. And then gender is inclusive of gender identity and gender expression. So I think that in the Irish context, nonetheless, there probably will be a lot of discussion about whether age should be a protected category. I think that will be a key issue, particularly as it was recommended in the Northern Irish context. And then also, I would imagine that organisations advocating for sex workers as well may also be seeking inclusion in the legislation.
Yeah, in one sense, this isn't our very first rodeo. Sure, it's not, Amanda, with respect to introducing hate crime legislation. So there's been two private members' bills. And what's really interesting in the parliamentary debates, the Dáil debates and the Shannon debates on the lapsed bills, as they now are, is that the politicians are almost falling over themselves to have more and more criteria, you know, to be for the legislation to be more inclusive rather than kind of having conversations about whether it was appropriate that a particular group should be included, which I thought was quite interesting in terms of the political debates that are happening here as compared to perhaps other jurisdictions. I know, Martin, as a neutral civil servant, you can't comment on what's happening politically in your own jurisdiction or where you're currently working, and probably others as well. But I think that it is quite interesting, the Irish political response to this, isn't it, Amanda?
Yeah, absolutely. And quite unusual, I think, that the greatest part of the discussion has actually been to critique proposed legislation for not being inclusive enough rather than seeking to actually exclude categories of people, which I actually think is really positive. But I suppose then we have to look at the issue as well, that if there are, I mean, we talked about the disadvantages of having an open-ended list effectively, but at the same time, you know, there is the view that is put forward that if you have too expansive of a list, then in many ways the message that is sent actually becomes meaningless. So there is probably a happy medium in between. that we need to achieve.
I suppose what I'm getting at is, how do you determine what is appropriate then to be in that list? You've already got these characteristics. They're quite, you know, it's quite an expansive list, but what's not included is subcultural identity. What's not included is homelessness. What's not included is social class. What's not included is ideological belief. What's not included is political affiliation. Mm-hmm. So when you're having these debates, what is it that makes something appropriate to be included in that list or not?
Can I come in there? Because I think legal certainty would knock off a few of those. So legal certainty would knock off political opinion, political identity, and subculture, you know, subcultural identity as well. Do you see what I mean? So I think that that is a useful initial means of determining.
Definitional and categorical certainty.
What is a political opinion? Is it about, you know, politics with a big P with a small P? Does it relate to immigration? Does it relate to what's actually happening in Parliament? Is it party politics? Or
it's too nebulous.
Right. It's not certain enough.
Certainly, you know, Equality Act in England and Wales, the, you know, category of religion or belief, you know, belief has, there's been a lot of consideration of what the content of that is, including what is and what is not a political belief for the purposes of those laws. So, yeah, it's certainly something that's had a lot of consideration.
And then I think there's the issue of, you know, whether in a jurisdiction you're moving towards protecting grounds, or are you protecting people with specific identities, which is maybe kind of a larger question about the type of framework that you're using. But I do think that it's a useful thing to consider, and that can help to make those determinations, or at least to help shape how those groups that merit inclusion are framed in the legislation. And I think, you know, in terms of the Irish approach, one of the things that is to its credit is that, you know, it's all neutral grounds, so that there is a sense of equality under the law, in that, you know, if you come back to what you were saying there, Mark, you know, everybody has a gender identity. And because it's gender inclusive of gender identity and gender expression is the way it's been framed in the Irish bill, and there is an equality in that approach, which I think is positive.
So after nearly an hour, we haven't come any closer to figuring out whether we should or shouldn't have a consistent set of criteria or approaches that could apply across our two islands in relation to inclusion or exclusion, Mark. That's unfortunate.
I was just writing down some notes for some concluding comments, and you've basically said exactly what I was going to say, Jennifer, which is this has been an absolutely fantastic, fascinating discussion. And I don't think we really resolved anything.
I think the conclusion is partially that it, you know, it is irresolvable. There isn't a perfect solution, but what there does need to be is as much transparency as possible about the basis on which the decisions, which will be necessarily imperfect, the basis on which those decisions were taken, so that they can be probed and challenged and questioned. And, you know, that is probably the means by which over time you get to the most appropriate list, rather than the appropriate list, which probably doesn't exist. I mean, I did want to come back to something that you said earlier, Mark, you know, about what is the core of, you know, what we mean when we talk about protected categories. And, you know, I think there's a sense in which it is about oppression on the basis of deeply embedded cultural prejudice. And I think, you know, that has to be at the core, and that has to be at the core of our considerations. And I do think that actually trying to make that explicit is actually really, really important to coming up with a framework against which different proposed categories can be tested. I think that there's a sense there in which, for me, this is always connected to issues around not just prejudice, but even stigma. And it's one of the reasons as well, I suppose, just coming back to that question of the open-ended list, why I don't think that that's the way forward. I think, Martin, you mentioned it, who is going to make the determination then as to whether somebody is protected or is not? And if it is the most stigmatized groups who are most likely to be subject to hate crime, if that's one of the things that puts you at risk of hate crime, then that stigma itself is going to be a barrier to people recognizing that what has happened to you is unacceptable and is in fact, it does in fact have a hate element to it. Like certainly in an Irish context, I mean, if you look at the types of deep-seated societal prejudice towards members of the traveller community, they are at a degree of virulence where it can be difficult sometimes for members of the majority population to recognise racism, anti-traveller racism, when it happens, because those prejudices are so culturally embedded. So naming categories, even if the list isn't perfect, that list is really, really important for those reasons.
I couldn't agree more, Amanda, and thank you for some wonderful and thoughtful and articulate final comments, I think, which brings us to the end of today's podcast. I hope others have found it equally as thought-provoking and helpful to your own thinking. Please do join us again for our next podcast in the series, and thank you very much and goodbye.
Hate Crime on the Two Islands is a podcast funded by the European Centre for the Study of Hate at the University of Limerick, written by Mark Walters and Jennifer Schwepp, and produced by Mark Walters, Jennifer Schwepp and Kate O'Donovan.